Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Daniel Gonzalez on the show. Daniel is a Central Valley native originally living in the rural community of Easton on the outskirts of Fresno. They are passionate about youth-driven policy change and decision-making and have a strong commitment to local issues. Daniel is a proud alumni of Fresno State with a bachelor's degree in sociology and a certificate in applied sociological research. They completed their Humanics at Fresno State program and are a former Bulldog Pride Fund Harvey Milk Humanics Hope Award scholar. As the senior program coordinator at the Youth Leadership Institute, Daniel oversees over 60 youth participants in Fresno's youth journalist and storytelling programs, including the No Youth Media, Multilingual Storytelling, and Journalists of Color. They organize weekly meetings with young people, building up their capacity in storytelling and community advocacy. Additionally, Daniel coordinates an annual youth-led multimedia positive social norms campaign around youth gambling prevention with the Betting on Our Future, a project of the California Friday Night Live partnership. On the weekends, you can find Daniel at local drag shows along friends, watching horror movies, or listening to countless hours of pop music. Let's go meet Daniel, and Baker will take us there.
To infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best!
So, Daniel, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
So I feel good old classic is me and Ed's for me.
That was going to, if you've listened to an episode, I always ask over underrated. So it would be underrated for you, me and Ed's.
Yeah, I don't know. I think people have really strong opinions about me and Ed's, I think, throughout like my adult life, meeting people from like other places, having friends from like the East Coast. They have so much.
Yeah, we can't trust their judgment on pizza in Fresno. They're just, it's so snobby.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know. It's such a classic for me. It reminds me of home. So whenever I'm not in Fresno, I think me and Ed's is what I'm always craving.
Yeah. So there's a follow-up question to this, and this comes up a lot when people talk about me and Ed's. They have a preferred location. Do you have a preferred me and Ed's location in town where you think they just do it right, if you will?
So mine hops around. And I don't know if it depends on what staff is there for that shift. I prefer the tower location at times. I live on, not to give away my address, but I live on Polk and Herndon, and there's a Me and Ed's right there. So I love that Me and Ed's. I think because when I get it delivered, it's fresh because it's down the street. And yeah, and my friends like the Coney Island slices. So
I don't like the Coney. I try with the Coney Island. I feel like the service is more variable there. My partner's preferred location is the Blackstone and Gettysburg one, which is a little bit of a drive for me. And I grimace when she wants pizza and I know where I have to go, but I do, their quality is consistent. But let's not, we could talk about this for a long time. Let's jump into just the array of topics that I'm excited to talk about with you today. How did growing up in Easton affect the way you view Fresno?
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think the way that I grew up is a little, it's very peculiar in the way that I grew up. So for the first 12 years of my life, I actually lived in Fresno, but went to school in Easton. So I did a little back and forth type of thing. And then when I was 12, I moved to Easton. So I think that I had a much more appreciation of living in the city a little bit more when I was doing that. But of course, like it not being too far from Fresno, I was there a lot. But I think, God, what am I thinking of? I think being in Easton, I don't know, it really just reminds me of like how privileged I could be just living in the city, and also takes me out of maybe the everyday struggles that folks live with living in the city as well. Things that I now know being a Fresno resident and having lived here my whole adult life. But yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah. What did you learn about communication, community, advocacy by being in band?
Oh, yeah. Lovely. I think that kind of goes hand in hand with what I do today. So like working with young people, it really did give me...
I was also a band nerd too. So I'll just say that at the jump here. And so I
have
my own opinions, but I'm curious about yours.
Yeah. I think it really gave me adult to like really latch onto as a young person. It gave me a sense of responsibility and a sense of community. I think that it took me a really long time to quote unquote find my tribe. And when I was in band, I really found that. I think that there weren't people who you just absolutely didn't like. You were just all like one big family. And I'm super lucky because going to Washington Union at that time, there was like a respect amongst like the athletes and band, which I can sometimes just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. And the school appreciated when we're at football games or like basketball games. And yeah, I really do appreciate the time that I had there because I don't think that I would have the sense of responsibility that I had going into college if I wasn't in band, because I know for sure I didn't have it in my education when I was in high school. So I think because I didn't have that going into college, I didn't have band, I took all that responsibility and kind of pushed it all into school.
Yeah, I view it as like, it's almost a cohort model, right? Because with most of your classes that you take in high school, you'll pop around a lot. There'll be different students in each classroom. But if you're in band, you're with the same people for four straight years. Some people rotate out or they decide they want to go a different direction with their extracurriculars. But I loved my experience in band and loved traveling and costumes and the whole thing. I thought it was great. For you, what's the most underrated instrument in band?
What's the most underrated instrument? I will say I'm a percussionist, but I'm more of a drummer. But the pit, so anything in the pit, so marimbas, vibraphones, bells, I think when I was in band, people wrote it off. And it was almost like, if you didn't make it to drumline, then you got assigned to go to the pit. Because it's like drumming, but it's not. And yeah, I don't know. I think people don't have as much respect for it. I think for me, all of my friends who are music majors at Fresno State were percussionists. And like my roommate is a percussion director. And so I got to go to all of their senior recitals. I got to see all of that kind of happen. And I got more of a respect for those instruments. So yeah, I would say anything in the pit.
I agree with you. I was in jazz band and there was a student, her name was Mackenzie. And she played the vibes and she would do the thing where you have like four sticks essentially in two per hand. And I would watch her like almost mesmerized as she would play scales and run up and down the vibes so quickly with four things that she's managing at once. I thought it was incredible. Let's jump to Fresno State now. Sociology is an interesting degree to me. It feels like as broad of a degree as there is and go 100 different directions. I'm a librarian. And so when I think about the Dewey Decimal System and I think about the category that is sociology, it encompasses so many different things and so many different kinds of titles. So for you, what is maybe one or two important concepts and tools that you took from that program that you still use today? I think when people think sociology, maybe they have some abstract thoughts, but they don't really have any like concrete things that they can latch onto.
Yeah, definitely. I think learning about social issues and how that intertwines in when it comes to like race and class and all of the identities that we all have, the intersectionalities that we all have. I think learning about sociological theory, I think I was a Marx person when I was going to school and I was really into Marx. So learning about this like grand utopia where we're all just gonna live together and we're free of all of these classes and we're one, I think those things really stuck with me as I was going through school and led with me onto like my professional career. I think with sociology, not really knowing what I wanted to do and really honed me in on, okay, so I think I want to focus on community issues. And then it's okay, I'm learning all of these different ways of like how in a society, folks are marginalized and folks are going to be oppressed. So what can I do to fix those things? I think in sociology, you maybe don't learn like, how can you fix those things? You learn about them. So I went down the path of, okay, I've learned like how this happened. Now let's figure out a way to be organized with the community and fix those things. Yeah, I think those are some of the things that stuck with me. And I really latched on to, and going to school and like sociology, I really honed in on like LGBTQ+ issues. I'm sure my professors were so tired of me because that's all I ever wrote about. But that's what I was interested in. And I got to take sociology of sexuality and gender, and that really helped me and triggered, okay, yeah, this is also a huge facet of what I want to do when I get older and like when I get out of school.
Yeah, I definitely remember when I read Foucault's History of Sexuality for the first time. And I was a history major, so we're like siblings in that domain, behavioral sciences or whatever. And I think there's just, I think looking at the world through those lenses is so helpful because it like, it politicizes, but also depoliticizes in some ways, where you can just look at the world like a specimen in a laboratory and just try to understand the structures at work. If you could go back and do one thing differently with your time at Fresno State, what would you do differently? Is there something that comes to mind?
I think I would find a better way to be social. So I think towards the latter part of my time at Fresno State, I had joined the humanities program. And I thought, okay, cool. So now I found like band, I found my tribe of people who were like, I was really close to and made really good friendships, but that didn't happen until my third year or so. And I got a really good group of people. So I think I would have joined more things at Fresno State, like United Student Pride. They always had, which is the LGBT group on campus. Their meetings just did not align with my school schedule. So I didn't have an opportunity to join that. And yeah, just finding more social time in school.
Yeah, I think that's such a hard thing. When I talk to kids about this and talk to them about getting involved, there's almost like this reverse causal argument they make in their heads is once I feel socially like open enough, then I'll join activities versus the reality, which is you join the activities and then that helps you become more social by joining those activities. And it's so hard because you have to feel the confidence to step out in uncomfortable environments where you don't know people and you have to put yourself out there. But sometimes that can be the solution to the problem itself. How did your 2 months as a fellow affect the way politics?
Oh, yeah, lovely. So the time that I had as an Equality California fellow, at that time, I really wanted to do legislative work. That was the goal. The goal was that, okay, let's see how the sausage is made. And this is the goal is for me to work here. I think I'm really grateful for the placement that I had. So I was an assembly member, Evan Lowe's office, and he represents San Jose, Campbell, that chunk of the Bay. And that office at that time, I believe he was chair of the LGBT legislative caucus. And they were really good at just like letting me, they're like, what do you want to do? Let's have you do these things. So I did the intern stuff where like I was making like social media graphics for his social media. There was an opportunity where they're doing a really big vote on environmental legislation on the assembly floor. And it was like a later night. And when it was all done, we went into the member's office and he asked all of the interns specifically, like what we saw, what we thought, and like how that made us feel. He really created a space where like we were able to learn and we were able to like really appreciate what was going on there. My time in the assembly, I was like, this is super cool. And but it was super stressful. So I think that was the thing that kind of got to me where I'm like, I don't know if I could handle the high pressure of this. The only time they really gave me something high pressure, which is not high pressure, but it was the member was, I think was in supposed to be in two committees at the same time. So he had to rush from one to the other. And I was in charge of taking him the binder for the second committee. And it was, I don't know, I felt it was high pressure because they're like texting me, he's over here, now he's over here, and you need to get to this place, and you need to get to that place. And it was so low stakes, but high stakes at the same time. And I was like, I don't know if I could do this. I like, this is their job every day. Can I do this? Those little things where I'm like, I'm not sure if I could do that. Meeting all the people there, super cool. All the staffers, not only in our office, but across the way. And then also the cohort that I was with, we're all queer identifying folks. And they really revolutionized the way that I view professionalism. I had never really seen queer people be professionals. I always thought for some reason that you would have to tone down your queerness in order to be taken seriously as a professional. And one of my colleagues that I had in the cohort, they were non-binary. And I remember the first day that we met at the Capitol, they were like wearing nail polish and like lipstick. And I was just like, oh, like they're really themselves. And we're here, like we're at the assembly and they're just being themselves. And that is what really, yeah, I clicked on a light and I was like, oh, like I can be myself in these spaces. And they now are made the road for folks like that in the assembly because I believe they were one of the first people to have like their pronouns on their assembly business cards. And I get to see them be themselves and they're doing great now. I believe they're a legislative director for one of the assembly members now. So yeah, I think that's what really, it made me feel like there was a future for me. And I'm really appreciative of the time that I was there.
That's a fantastic story. Not everyone leaves the halls of the assembly with positive experiences. So yeah. I'm glad that yours was. Let's transition to talking about the Youth Leadership Institute now. What is it and how did you find yourself working at it?
Yeah, of course. After my time at the assembly, I graduated school and I actually had the opportunity to intern in then Senator Kamala Harris's office. So I was in Senator Harris's office for about a year. And I think that experience was the other, not to say nail in the coffin, but I was like, this is a lot. Because at the time she was running for president for the first time, the calls were a little high pressure. And I think
What did you learn about her that maybe people on the outside wouldn't know?
Unfortunately, I never met her. But I think something that I learned both in the assembly and working for the Senate for that year is that the culture really comes from the top. However, the members is usually how staff is going to be. And
I bring that up because there has been some criticism about her management style. I've heard this on and off, and I wasn't sure if you were on the receiving end of any of that.
No, not straight from her, but I think the way that the culture was in the office was very much, it was laid back to an extent, but also we were very aware that if she were to come, it is both, she's going to be cool, but don't mess up your job. do your job.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So, and I was like, that's fine. Like, I do my job all the time. So, yeah, I think that's what it was like. But yeah, so then, I think my director saw like the stress I was under taking those really volatile calls we were getting at the time, and we're like, hey, and they were helping me out. They were like getting me interviews to work in city council and things like that. But then they're like, I don't know if this is for you, but there's an organization that we think would really align with you. And that was the Youth Leadership Institute. And luckily they were closed for interviews, but they like gave me an opportunity to do that. And I got to interview the Youth Leadership Institute. Essentially what we are, we're a statewide organization. We have 8 offices across California and we're a youth development organization. So we build partnerships between young people and their adult allies to build and affect community change through a social justice and racial equity lens. We serve young people between the ages of 14 to 24. And although we have those 8 offices across, 8 offices across the state, each one, we do youth development work, but it's also specific to what we're doing in each office. So each office does not have the same programs. You're going to find something a little bit different in each office. And yeah, at this point, I've been there for about 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really worked out, really brought in a lot of the legislative experience that I've had in the past, knowing how that process works, knowing how meeting with decision makers are, and all of those things.
Fantastic. Let's jump into some of the programs. I have questions about a number of them. I want to start by talking about tobacco and alcohol, something that you worked in a while ago. I know this is maybe not fresh, but I'm curious, do you think it's easier or harder for kids living in a small town to get their hands on substances versus a kid that maybe lives in Southwest Fresno?
Yeah, I think it depends. I think it depends on the culture of the community. I think myself coming from Easton, I knew how folks were like getting access to those things. And typically it was from parents. It was from, they were doing those things with their parents. In terms of in South Fresno, I think what's different is that the culture isn't so much just through your family and your community. It's also through advertisements. So I think when you're living in Fresno, you are more inundated with billboards and signs at your liquor stores and like all of those things. If you're living in the city, you have access to Wi-Fi and internet. So you're also getting ads on your social media and like your YouTube ads. I think you're a little more inundated. In terms of access, I think access is the same. You're gaining access from those adults. And yeah, so that's how it's the same, but also how it differs from like living in a small area than being in Southwest Fresno.
Yeah, so in terms of working with merchants and educating them about minors and alcohol, so I went to school at San Francisco State and there was a liquor store, I don't know, maybe 2 miles from campus that everyone went to get their booze, like including me. And it was just known that was the place where your ID didn't matter. And I know things have obviously changed since I was in college in the mid-2000s. I don't know what the current state of like kids accessing these substances through business establishments, if that's still very much a presence, or are kids using the Hey Mister model, you know, that I used at some points in my lifetime?
Yeah, I think in terms of access to merchants, I think luckily merchants are a little more educated. And if they're not, through our programs, we educate them on those things. But it's very much, hey, if you give them access to alcohol, you're going to lose your liquor license and you're going to lose out on business. And of course, their liquor license is where a good bulk of their money is going to come from.
Is it ubiquitous that merchants are selling to underage kids, or do you think that's pretty rare these days?
I would say, I think it depends. I think it, because I think you could probably get away with something like that in a smaller community that like where I grew up, right? Is that everyone knows, but everybody keep it on the hush because not everybody should know. So yeah, I think it depends. But of course, places like bigger stores or like chains, that they obviously will not do that. Even though I feel like they have more of the means to fight those things, I don't think they would ever do those things. But yeah.
What's interesting awesome. Is there was a few years ago, I think it was Vox, ran a feature on how kids these days are, teen pregnancies down, and they're looking at the aggregate here. They're not necessarily talking specifically about Fresno, but kids are using less alcohol, smoking less cigarettes. I don't think they were really accounting for vaping in this particular article, but saying essentially that kids are safer in some ways, but more isolated. And that's been the kind of broader trend. Do you see that as well? Like less harmful substances, but more social isolation?
Yeah, I would say that. I think the social isolation is probably coming from the pandemic. I think that's what we've really been experiencing too in our programs, of just trying to get young people out of their shell and be more social. I think in terms of substance use, when I was working in prevention at YLI, I worked in rural areas. So I was working in Orange Cove, Selma, and Reedley. And when it came to them, I think a lot of them went to, our goal was to do campaigns surrounding alcohol prevention for young people. I think through the pandemic, young people were a little more social isolated than they had been. Trying to get them out of their shell has been an issue that we've been dealing with at the org. I think in terms of substances, when I was working in the rural areas of East Fresno County, so I was working in Reedley, Orange Cove, and Selma, our goal was to do underage alcohol prevention work. And at the time when we were trying to come up with a campaign, a lot of them were saying alcohol isn't necessarily the issue on campus. It is mostly vaping, and it was like marijuana usage. At the time, we weren't doing marijuana prevention at the org, and their concern wasn't necessarily like they're vaping and this is bad for them. Their big concern was like they're closing the bathrooms and there's only one bathroom to use in the entire school. And it'd be cool if people weren't vaping.
I can tell you that's still the underlying issue, 100%.
Yeah. And I think also hearing from them as well is that they're vaping in classrooms, like when the teacher has their back turned. And it wasn't so much that it was like, oh, we're worried about their health. It was just, they're distracting everybody in this environment where we're trying to do something. And I thought it was so interesting because when I was in school, I was like, oh, damn, y'all want to learn? I wasn't like that when I was in high school, but it was cool. I was like, oh, okay, cool. We're doing campaigns around that. But I think another thing is like when we talked about like alcohol prevention, a lot of it came from like cultural traditions, and it was things that we really bonded over. So it's cultural traditions of the social norm of having so much alcohol at a family party. The things we really bonded over was like when you're at a two-year-old's birthday party and they have like kegs, like why? Like, why is that cool? And why did we need that? And we really bonded over that. And I was like, yeah, so what if we didn't do that? And yeah, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with access, right? When you have access to those things at home, at family parties, I think, speaking from my own experience and also my young people, when I had those conversations with them, it's such a cultural experience growing up in my own Latino community, is that you get your first sip of a beer at a family party when you're like really young. And it's just, or sometimes it's like a little kid will grab a beer and then they're about to drink it. Usually you stop them. They're like, no, let them drink it. Like they'll see how nasty it is and they'll stop. Those little things, like they matter, because if you're take a little sip when you're 8, then who knows by the time like you're 13 or 14, like you're already pounding back like a 6-pack with your friends. But yeah.
Yeah. The other area that you've worked with kids, and this is another moral issue, quote unquote, is around gambling. When I was in middle and high school, this obviously was before smartphones, we would take dollar bills and fold the edges and flip them. And that was like, it's basically a form of playing dice, if you will, in some capacity. But nowadays, kids have smartphones, and if they can figure out a VPN or get their parents login to one of those player prop apps or Caesars, who knows, they can be gambling all day long. But for me, how pervasive is that? Is gambling really pervasive amongst kids these days?
Yeah, I think these days it's really, and this is something that I had to learn as well, because in my mind, I'm thinking like, oh, okay, you're gambling at school or you're using those apps specifically. But young people these days through like Roblox and like all of these different like types of games that they play, they have these things called loot boxes. So essentially you buy these boxes and you don't really know what's inside of them. It could be a new skin for your character. It could be different weapons. It could be different things like that. And you have to accumulate, I believe you have to accumulate points, or you could buy points in order to get those things. And that's how it's happening these days, where it's like they're using their money to get these like randomized boxes that could be anything. And that is like what they're pouring their money into. Even though it's not traditional gambling in the way that you're competing for something, they're still pouring their money into something for the randomized game of winning a big prize. Because
I wouldn't even classify that as gambling in my mind, but that makes perfect sense. It's almost like a claw machine or you'd, yeah, like a Pokemon card pack in some ways, like when I was a kid.
Yeah. And they're pouring, if they're making their own money, they're pouring their money in. But if they're not pouring their own money in, they're asking their parents for money to do that. And I think that's another thing too. It's like when we talk about like underage gambling, I realized, I think as an adult, like going to Dave & Buster's and going to arcade games, I was like, wait, this was when I was younger, this was like my form of gambling in a way, that when you keep going back and you ask my mom for, can I have an extra $5? And she's like, no, you've already spent too much money. I feel like that's how I viewed, when I turned 18, that's how I was when I was gambling. When my parents had taken me to Table Mountain when I turned 18, they're like, oh, you get to gamble now. And that's what I felt like. I think they gave me $100 to like start off with. And then I think I played a Michael Jackson slot and then I lost everything. And then I was like, at that point, I was still in high school. And I think I spent like the $20 I had for lunch for the week. And I was like, this isn't good. I really should stop. If I was 8 and I had this money, then I would just keep going and asking my mom for more. So yeah, I think the way young people are gambling, it's different now. So we're really trying to get ahead of that, figure out different ways for them. So hopefully not, because the main goal is for them to not create that habit. Because of course, as they get older, if they have that habit with them, then it could be more destructive, especially when they get their adult jobs and they're making more money.
Yeah. All right. We're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. Tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. We are recording this before Halloween, and I've got some horror movies for you as well. Just perfect. We're in that season right now. And so we're going to start with the original Halloween movie. Is it over or underrated? The OG, the original.
Overrated.
Overrated. Okay. This is interesting. I think we're going to disagree on this. I love that movie. Tell me why you think it's overrated.
I don't know. I think it's really slow. I think it's really slow. I can recognize when those OG horror movies, like, oh, like they're creating the path. They've created the path. They forged this path of like what we can do now. And since I've seen what we can do now, I'm like, okay, so we don't have to go this, we don't have to like kind of chug along in this like really long movie. I think also recently, like on the internet, just little silly things, of course, like I know it was like at that time, like a low budget movie, but the silly things of like when Michael Myers is driving the car and then you could see him like with the mask on and he's looking both ways before he like drives the car across, just little silly things. And I'm like, why did we do that? That's so silly.
Have you seen memes on TikTok where there's someone that dresses up like him and is at an intersection and does like the quick pan to the car next to the people scream? I love that so much. All right. Next one. The Tower Theater as a venue. Is that over or underrated?
Oh, underrated.
Okay. Why is it so great?
Recently, I had the opportunity to host a queer housing summit there, alongside South Tower Community Land Trust and like Fresno EOC LGBT Resource Center. And I have been there before. I went to go see a Queen tribute and I thought it was really cool. And that was years ago. But I think actually being there and being in the green room, seeing the venue is beautiful. It's so beautiful. I think it's a perfect size. I am actually trying to go there. I think there's like a Led Zeppelin cover band coming in December of all like female led musicians. And I'm trying to see it there because I just think it's a perfect size.
Okay. Next one, Bianca Del Rio, over or underrated in your mind?
Oh God, that's hard.
Obviously very highly rated in some circles, obviously, but for you.
She's exactly where she needs to be, I think.
Okay, properly rated. Okay. For those who don't know Bianca Del Rio, could you give a little explanation?
Yeah, so Bianca Del Rio, she was and is a New York City legend. She is kind of insult comic in the vein of Joan Rivers. And she appeared on season 6 of RuPaul's Drag Race, and then she became the winner. I think she has been the only clear winner, if I can remember, even to this day. When she set her foot on the scene, it was like, oh, she's going to win this. And I just think her comedy, it doesn't get old. I think we're at a time now, especially with drag, where we're really trying to police certain things in terms of like political correctness. Of course, don't do anything that is so inherently, that is rooted in negativity, rooted in horrible things, or like trying to make people feel bad. But at the same time, she is like a drag queen's drag queen in the terms of humor, right? She's mean, she's funny, she's quick, and you just have to roll with the punches. Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoy the comedy. All right, next one. If, and one of these places no longer exists, so I'm curious your perspective. Fab or Splash?
I have to say Splash.
Okay. The one that still exists. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. As someone who like is a independent contractor there, I would say Splash. However, I had such beautiful times and memories of going to Fab. I went to Fab when I turned 21. I met my first RuPaul's Drag Race queen there when I turned 21. I've seen so many RuPaul's Drag Race queens there, met them. And also local queens. I got to see so many local queens because at that time I was 21. But yeah, but for now I will say it's Splash all the way.
Okay. Next one. Another horror movie. The Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, it's underrated. It'll never be. Yeah, it's never overrated for me. It's one of my favorite, like all-time favorite movies.
What's your favorite scene? If you had to pick a scene, the most rewatchable scene, what would you say?
What is my most... There's so many. I would say the Buffalo Bill scene, like towards the end when he's dancing. Yeah, that really just is ingrained in my brain. And I like to see, I don't know. I was like, wow, this is cool. And I was like, is this me? In some ways, I was like, he is doing his makeup and he's dancing. And I was like, I do that. I do that in my room. I dance and I do my makeup. But if I will say, my favorite line is when Hannibal Lecter meets up with the senator on the tarmac and he insults her. And then at the end, he's, oh, Senator, love your suit. It's one of my favorite lines from that movie.
Yeah, there's so many scenes. It's one of my favorite horror films. Honestly, I'm a little boring. I just like the kind of the banter when he's in his cage. There's just something, and obviously the face removal scene. There's just so, it's really hard. And then Buffalo Bill's voice. It's just permanently in my brain. I can't do it. I would try to imitate it, but it would just come out poorly. all right. Next one. It's a book and a show, Heartstopper.
Oh, God. I don't know.
I have a leaning myself on this. I'm curious yours.
I want to say it's overrated, but...
That's what I was going to say, too.
I don't know. I haven't seen the second or third season that's on Netflix, but when I watched the first one, I don't know. It just expresses so much queer joy. And I remember watching it and I was like, these two little gays, they're so in love. And I was like, and they just keep falling more and more in love. It's like, what's happening? This never happens. I remember I was on a work trip. And I was on the last few episodes and I remember telling my manager, I was like, we're all good. Like, young people are in their rooms. We're all good. Okay, cool. I'm going to go to my room and I'm going to cry at the last two episodes of Heartstopper. And he was like, okay.
All right. Next one. And this, I believe, just had a new book. Yes. I forget the name of the new book. Let me see. I'm going to look this up real quick because I want to get it right. Where? Publications. There you go. Yeah. So the new book is called Who's Afraid of Gender? And this is Judith Butler. Underrated or overrated?
Oh, underrated. I think underrated because not enough people know Judith Butler. I think also, I can't even say that I'm so much of an expert on Judith Butler either.
Hard to read at points, yes.
Yeah. And see, and I don't read as much as I did when I was going to school. And even then, I think when I was going to school, I really trained myself on like how to read academically. But yeah, I think also like a tie to RuPaul's Drag Race, I believe Sasha Velour was going to be Judith Butler for Snatch Game. And they were like, why? And I think she ended up being Marlena Dietrich. But yeah, so I would say underrated.
And the new book is pretty good. It feels like the most accessible. It's called Who's Afraid of Gender? And it's interesting in a way because it's like I would almost send the book to anyone, no matter their political persuasion. Like it's very persuasive across a political spectrum, which is unlike some of the previous work, which is both dense and couldn't be read with outside of a small niche of progressive circles and makes sense. So anyway, I was just curious your perspective. Let's go on to the next one. Just a few more. Trixie Mattel.
I love Trixie. I don't think she's overrated. But I don't think she's underrated. She's perfectly where she's supposed to be. Yeah, arguably probably the most successful drag queen right now. And yeah, she's one of my favorites. When she was on season 7 of Drag Race, she was one of my favorites from the jump. And I was like, she looks different. And she's funny. And I loved her. And then she got eliminated twice on that season. So, and then I was also the sore one out when I wanted her to win All Stars. And then she won. And then all my friends were like, well, you got what you wanted and nobody wanted this.
Let's jump to the last section here. We're going to talk a little bit about journalism and a few other things. Let's start by talking about training young journalists. What are the most common areas of interest when you're working with young budding journalists? What are they interested in? What do they want to write about?
Yeah, I think they're mostly just trying to write about their community. And I think it's mostly us trying to get them to write about their community. When they're really starting out and they're like, oh, this thing is bugging, the streets in my neighborhood suck or things like that. I don't really like how there's no access to go to these places. And it's usually us like, you can write about it. Feel free to write about it. It's okay. Because what's really cool about our program is that even though we are teaching them those tools to put in their journalism tool belt, we really do emphasize them telling their stories about themselves, writing personal narratives or writing op-eds. We really encourage them, like, you do not have to write like a full-blown news story. You don't have to go interview people. Just write about how you're feeling. Write an op-ed. Write to the people who are in charge and tell them how you feel about the things that you need in your community. So I think that's usually what they want to do, especially now. They really want to talk about their life story. We have young people writing about, we had someone write about what it was like growing up as the youngest sibling, or folks talking about like when they moved from like Mexico to Fresno, what that culture shock was like. So I think they really love telling their stories and like who they are.
Do you think young journalists are pessimistic or optimistic about the future?
From my conversations with them, it's so like up in the air. Because I have young people that are so pessimistic about the future. And I get it. I can't argue with them. I'm just like, yeah, I know. Your experience in this world is completely different than mine. But shockingly enough, there are a lot of young people who are very optimistic about the future. And not only because of just like their point of view, but I think also them taking ownership of what they can do. So I think there are a good amount of young people who are optimistic.
Okay. And when you're evaluating them, and not just in the sense of teaching them a trade or a skill, what do you think are their strengths that they come in with, and where do they need the most help?
I think their strengths are being confident in their telling their story. So that is where their strength is. Their strength is going full in on that. I would say their weaknesses are utilizing those tools that we give them for their tool belt. But to me, it's us reminding them, don't forget that we have to write an AP style because we're still a publication. So these little AP style rules, you need to apply them. Don't forget that this is also a publication, so it doesn't have to be long form paragraphs. I think it's trying to get them to unlearn the parameters of an English class in high school, where it has to be 4 sentences in order for it to be a paragraph. And like, it has to have all these things. And it's like deconstructing that. And it's tough for them. And usually we have to do it in the editing stage. But of course, over time, they eventually get it. But specifically those folks who are like fully in, are looking to be a journalist when throughout college or outside of college in their professional career, those are the ones that really hone in on those skills.
One of the biggest challenges that I experience both in the classroom, but also working with young people, is giving them feedback that they can receive. I think Gen Z, Zoomers, and then what's the new generation?
Gen X?
Alpha, yeah. Where they're very in touch with their emotions, their feelings, which is a beautiful thing to see newer generation, because we just sublimate with work. Millennials were just like, let's just work really hard and we'll feel better later. The obverse of that, though, is in giving them feedback, it can quickly get personal. And so I have struggled in figuring out avenues, because that's our role, ultimately, is to help facilitate their growth. How have you thought about giving feedback to the kids that you work with in ways that they will receive?
Yeah, I think in the way that I try to is a very classic, like the compliment sandwich of, you did this very well, maybe work on this, but you did this very well too. I think that's one way. Another cool thing about like the Youth Leadership Institute is that we have a lot of young people who are across different programs. So we share young people throughout different programs. So I think another thing that we do is if there's something going on, or like we think there's something going on, or if we had to give them feedback and that wasn't received well, we can lean on like other coordinators or other folks working with them to be like, hey, can you check on them to make sure they're good?
You can find the right fit.
Yeah. And finding out like how they feel, and if that coordinator can talk to them about maybe Daniel didn't mean it that way and those things, or they can tell me and I'm like, okay, cool. So now I can check in on them and let them know, hey, I heard you're feeling this way. Don't worry about it. It's all good. Those are the things that I really had to learn, not coming from like a youth development or like a youth background, is like working with young people and trying to find ways to encourage them and uplift them without breaking their spirits in any ways. Cause yeah, it is very personal. Like, it's personal when you're getting feedback on like a story that you wrote about your life. So trying to find ways to do that.
Let's give an example. I read an op-ed by, I don't really know any of the background of the person that wrote it. Domaris Sid, is that how you say their name?
Oh yeah.
The op-ed about protest votes, essentially it was writing in something Palestinian related. It's an op-ed that was focused on activism. Can you talk about like the process of that coming to fruition? Was it something like where they're workshopping it with staff and then they work it and there's a revision process? Can you just talk about start to finish, like the kids and the adults that you work with, how do they go through the process of writing an article like that?
Yeah, so it depends. It really varies. So there are some issues where the young people come to us and say, hey, we think this is an issue and we really want to write about it. And we're like, yeah, go ahead, feel free to do that. But then there are other things where like myself and my manager, Johnson, we will see something in the news and we're like, hey, we think this is something that could be a really good story. And the thing is that we'll see things from like local publications and folks writing about things, but our goal is to get the youth perspective on what it is. So then we bring it up to them like, hey, here's the story from, for example, here's the story from Fresno Land of something going on. Does anybody want to cover it or write an op-ed about how you feel about it? Essentially what happens is they'll write their story, they'll write their draft. It'll get sent to me during this time, or like either the fall or the spring. We have Fresno State service learners who need to complete hours for their classes. They also attend our meetings with the NO. And what they do is they're the first line. I call them the first line of defense. So they read the stories first and they give edits, goes back to the young person. Young person makes the edits until they get to a good point, and then they come to me and then I do my edits if there are any. And then the last person is going to be Johnson. Since my background isn't necessarily in journalism and Johnson's is, that's why he gets the last say of if there was anything that I missed. And yeah, and that's how it gets published. And then depending on what it is or who the young person is, they could either take a picture of their own while they're at wherever they were. If they're covering an event, they can have one of their fellow youth reporters go and cover it in terms of photography. Or we have a lot of illustrationists in our midst at the NO. So they can link up with someone and have someone draw a picture. And that'll be the picture for the piece. Yeah. And then it goes up on our website, goes up on social media. And the cool thing about our program is that young people get compensated for all of the work they do. So if they write the piece and it gets published on our website, they're getting paid for that. If they take a picture, they're getting paid. If they're drawing a picture, they get paid for it. Yeah. That's like what the process looks like from start to finish.
All right. Before we wrap up, a few questions about drag. What's the most common misunderstanding about drag?
Most common misunderstanding about drag. I feel like these days, the most common misunderstanding of drag, I think, is that we're trying to recruit young people or something weird like that. And yeah, I feel like that is so far from the truth. I think it also depends. There's also so much nuance with drag. Like when I started doing drag, I was telling folks at work, I was like, feel free to come to my shows, but I want you all to know that the drag persona that I have and like the content that I give out is made for adults who are over 21 at a bar. That is what I do. But that doesn't mean that it negates the drag queens who want to do story time hour. And that's all like their goal. Their goal is to do story time hour and to like work with kids and be like that safe space for young people. But it also doesn't negate the fact that my content majority is for 21-year-olds in a club, that I can't perform like a family-friendly performance or host a family-friendly event at Pride or Queer Housing Summit or things like that. It's all about time and place. And it's also like, also we're not trying to recruit young people to do drag. If they want to do drag as an art form, that is cool, but we don't need any more people on the scene.
Yeah. What is for you a definition of a good drag show? What is the rubric you would use to evaluate whether a show is a good drag show or not?
I love variety. So I love a variety of performances, a variety of concepts. So you would have your traditional quote unquote pageant queen who is going to go out in the gown, do what we call a park and bark, who knows all her lyrics and is just sitting there doing a ballad, emoting really well. And then you have a very artistic performer. It's very conceptual. You don't really know what's going on, but there's a very strong concept. And then you have a zany performer. Those are usually my favorite, who are zany and no one really knows what's happening. And some people are a little scared, like they don't know what's going on. Yeah. And then you have a dancing queen. So you have someone who's dancing and like doing pop songs. I just like variety and I like commitment. So whatever you're doing, like commit to it. Me and my friends tell each other, commit to the bit. And that's all you got to do. I think that's the thing with drag, is you just got to commit to whatever you're doing. And if people don't like it, you're not doing it for them. You're doing it for yourself.
Couldn't agree more. If you could change one thing about Fresno Pride, what would you change?
I don't know. I feel
like more programming of some kind or something with the parade, or is there anything you would change to make it either more inclusive or more exciting?
I would say maybe the only thing that I would change and that I hear a lot like from the community is I feel like Fresno Pride is growing, which is great, but it really does feel like we're turning into the bigger cities of like it has turned into like this corporatization of Pride. So we're seeing a lot of like more corporate folks like being a part of the parade, which is great because like we're getting like more people there and like all of those things. But I think at the end of the day, Pride is a celebration of a protest that happened, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And that's what it's rooted in. It's rooted in trans women of color, like fighting to just exist, to be in a bar without getting thrown in jail. So I would say that, but at the same time, it's been really nice to see Pride grow.
Yeah. I ask this question to everybody, and I like, and I'm curious about how what people do in their professional and personal lives affects the way they see Fresno. I work in education, so I tend to see the world through that lens, both in problems and solutions. How does the work you do, your work in drag, how does that affect the way Fresno?
I would say I feel more a part of Fresno than ever now. And I feel like that's how it affects what I want to see, because I want to see Fresno grow and thrive in the best way possible. As a professional, I think working with young people, trying to figure out policies that they are most passionate about, things that they want to see change in Fresno, I get to do it in that way. And I get to be in the nitty gritty of those things. But I think doing drag, I just really feel a part of Fresno, being there more of a social scene type of way, but also trying to bring in the organizing part of it as well, like trying to get to a different audience rather than just the young people that I'm working with during the day. It's also getting the club goers and the people who just want to go see drag, because I think you'll get to them And it's like right now, I think when I host, I'm really trying to get them energized to vote, especially in their local elections. So yeah, I think that's how I really, I don't know, that's how I view Fresno. It's just, I'm part of it now. And now I think I feel even more passionate to make sure that we're in tip-top shape.
Fantastic. We always close in the same place with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I would say, what are some of my favorites? I'll do three. This will be my compliment sandwich. It'll be When We Rise by Cleve Jones. And it also became a short series on ABC, I believe. I had the opportunity to meet Cleve Jones when I was at a conference in San Francisco. I was like Harvey Milk's right-hand man, but it's his life story. Really, I really romanticized the idea of living in San Francisco in the 70s. So that's what it is. Then I would say Thinner by Stephen King. Love the movie, but I love the book even more. I think it's scarier. I read it in high school and it terrified me more than the movie ever could. And then the last book I would say is The Velvet Rage. I forget who it's by, but The Velvet Rage is about like young, like gay men and their connection to like masculinity and toxic masculinity. And also like the relationships they have with their fathers or lack thereof. That also revolutionized and took me for a loop when I read it in college. So I would say those three.
Perfect. Daniel, if people are interested in learning more about the Youth Leadership Institute and maybe getting involved, where should they go?
Yeah, so you can visit our website at yli.org, or you can follow us on all social media platforms, I believe, at YL Institute. Those are our handles. Yeah, and you could see where you can get involved, or if you have any young people in your life who want to join programming, send them our way.
And what's next for you? Are there any projects in the works that you'd like to share with us?
As for me, we're really in the midst of campaign season for us. So we're just working on various policy things, trying to get young people organized, see what they want to do next. And then as for drag, I think I'm actually going to take a little break for a little bit. So I have a show next week. And then I had back surgery in July. So I really shouldn't be performing. So I think I'm going to have my last show next week and then probably come back at the beginning of the new year.
Fantastic. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And I appreciate all the work you're doing in Fresno.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating or review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.